Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Esther. We've come today to Esther chapter 5. I said in a couple of studies ago that it's a lot easier, I find, to cope with unpleasant and the unexpected if one knows that what goes wrong is not just my dumb luck, in street language, but part of God's plan. I would remind us that most of us are kind of conditioned to see the activity of God only in the big events, what I call the seismic events. But we should never forget that God works in and through the small and most ordinary things, and we see that vividly, dramatically illustrated in the book of Esther. I love the way the providence of God works, and we see it so spectacularly demonstrated in this book. The first thing we have to learn about history and human events and experiences is that things are not always what they seem. Things that happen, of course, really happen, but looking at them from the horizontal, that is, from just the human vantage point, we have only a shallow interpretation of events. Rare is the historian who, in assessing the record of past events, sees or even acknowledges the hand of God, and that's really no surprise. The minute people bring God into the equation of human history as an explanation for events, what the Greeks used to call the deus ex machina, at that point we lose control and become accountable for our actions. And nobody wants that. That is a yoke that man in his irrepressible pride forever seeks to throw off. So nobody wants to see the hand of God in human events except those of us who know Him, love Him, and trust Him. Deceive ourselves as we may, close our eyes as we will, the providence of God is a compass that guides events in that macro sense that we call history, but also in that micro aspect that we think of as personal experience. The providence of God is there. Now, the providence of God, as I'm using the phrase here, consists in those human agents and impersonal instruments whereby God secretly guides His purpose in all creation to its triumphal conclusion. That's what we see in the book of Esther, and as I pointed out several times, this book is a pattern, it's a model for the way God still works, that same God, in our personal experience. Perhaps not as dramatically, but nevertheless, the hand of God, the hidden hand of God, is always there in the events and the experiences of our lives. Many have been troubled by what is called the secularity of the book, that is, the name of God is never mentioned. But what they overlook is that that's the very point, because this book is about the hidden hand of God. But I don't think anybody can read it discerningly and honestly without seeing the hand of God all over it. And I showed you in the words of Mordecai in chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, that very obviously Mordecai has God in his sights. So we continue to see through this book how the providence of God works. We've come to the point where Mordecai, the adopted father of Queen Esther, the queen of the Persian king Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, as he's better known to us in secular history, has just discovered through Mordecai that the king has published an edict at the instigation of Haman the Agite, which signifies that he was a descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites, and here Mordecai is a descendant of the house of Saul. And it was the house of Saul that was commissioned to destroy the Amalekites, but Saul shortchanged that commission, and that got Saul and his house removed to be replaced by David and his house. So it's really an irony in the providence of God that here descendants of these two houses collide in the kingdom of Persia. Mordecai will not bow to Haman for that reason, and Haman is infuriated by the impudence of Mordecai, and when he learns that he is a Jew, he's all the more so, and he determines that he wants to take out the whole Jewish nation that resides in the Persian kingdom. And so he conspires with the consent of the king to rid the kingdom of this pestilent people. And of course, the king is kind of sucked in and doesn't realize what is going on. It's no big deal to him to remove the Jewish people, not knowing that his own queen is a Jewess, because Mordecai had warned Esther when they were selecting a new queen not to reveal that ethnic fact to the king. So it comes about in chapter 5, on the third day of fasting, on her part, Mordecai's part, and the part of the Jewish people throughout the realm who were facing a massacre. It came about on the third day of that fasting that Esther put on her royal robes, and at the insistent request of Mordecai, she stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's room. The king was sitting on his royal throne opposite the entrance of the palace, and Esther is taking her life in her very hands because there was a law, as we've seen earlier, for the safety of the king, I'm sure, that no one should come into the throne room without the king extending his royal scepter. Should someone do that, it was an immediate death sentence. So it happened when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. The king gave Esther a pass. He extended the golden scepter which was in his hand. And so Esther was able to come near and touch the top of the scepter. And of course the king wanted to know what was troubling Esther, that she would take such a chance. And obviously she must have some request, so he asked her, "What is it that you want to ask?" And then very generously, but in a kind of conventional way, he said, "Even to the half of my kingdom it will be given to you." Esther did not immediately tell the king what she wanted, but she said coyly, "If it please the king, may the king and Haman, who had been elevated to second in power in the Persian Empire, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet I have prepared for him." Well, the king said, "Bring Haman quickly to his attendants, that we may do what Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. And then something quite peculiar happens as they drank their wine at the banquet. The king said to Esther, "Now, dear," as I paraphrase, "what is your petition?" "It'll be granted to you." "What's your request?" "Even to half the kingdom it'll be done for you." Esther answered and said, "My petition and my request is this. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." Now, what I say is peculiar about that, and you probably feel it as I do in the narrative, is why would Esther be moved to defer giving the king her petition? When the table was set, Haman was right there, and she could have told the king what Haman has done, the way he had been more or less misled into granting this petition, and asked that they come to dinner the next day. Well, we can't be sure about this, but it seems to me that, first of all the pieces were not in place. Something that's coming up needs to happen first in order to dispose the king to grant Esther's request without any hesitation. But Esther wouldn't know that. This is the secret hand of God, the hidden hand of God. So why would she defer since she didn't know the rest of the pieces of the puzzle needed to be in place? Why would she do that? My suspicion is, if you'll notice in chapter 5, verse 6, as they drank their wine at the banquet, there was nothing abnormal about that. But when these people drank, they drank. They drank heavily. And it was possible that Esther just sensed that they were too much into their cups and now wasn't the time to bring this up. Or it may just be as simple as the fact that Esther, not knowing that it was the Spirit of God, somehow felt prompted to just delay until the next day. In any case, it's all the providence of God at work. Well, I'm telling you, this invitation to a banquet with only Queen Esther and the king really made Haman feel elevated and swelled up with pride. So we read in verse 9 of chapter 5 that Haman went out that day. He was very pleased of heart, but something again just split his britches. When Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, the adopted father of Esther, and I remind you that the king's gate was a place of some influence. Powerful people were there. He wasn't on the inside of the palace, but he had acquired some stature to be in that venue. And Mordecai did not stand up or tremble before him like everybody else. Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. But he controlled himself, went on to his house, sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. And over dinner, Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches, the number of all of his sons. That was a big deal in ancient times, a great extended family. And he chronicled for them every instance where the king had magnified him. Man just full of pride and vanity, and how the king had promoted him above the princes and the servants of the king. And you're beginning to get the sense that pride is going to have a great fall. But then Haman lets it out, even though the queen let nobody but me come with the king to the banquet that she had prepared. And in fact, I'm invited tomorrow by her to be with the king. Yet I got to tell you, Haman says to his family and closest confidants and associates, boy, it eats my lunch. All of this promotion and all of this power does not satisfy me every time I see that guy Mordecai, the Jew. This is the Amalekite coming out. I see him sitting in the king's gate. I tell you, I can't stand it, is the idea. Well, then his wife and his friends become his counselors, and they say to him in verse 14, well, why don't we just take care of that problem? That's what we would advise. Look, nobody has the king's ear like you do. So this night, have gallows 50 cubits high. That's 75 feet high. Have those gallows made. When we say gallows, we're probably talking about a pike 75 feet high, because it was the Persian custom, not without exception, but it was the Persian custom to impale people on long poles. So have a gallows 50 cubits high. Man, get it up there so everybody can see it and impale him on that. And just having grotesquely stuck him on the end of that thing, let everybody see what happens to people who insult you like that. And then tomorrow go joyfully with the king to the banquet. Well, that advice immensely pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made that very evening. But then something happened. Boy, this is the providence of God. God is not mentioned, but this is God at work. Satan is at work in Haman, but God is counteracting every move. During the night, the king could not sleep. That's the providence of God. We don't know why he couldn't sleep. Maybe he had acid reflux. Who knows? But the point is, though God is not mentioned, the secret hand of God is in this so that King Ahasuerus could not sleep. Who would imagine that there's a great drama unfolding in that simple fact? Just the fact that a king couldn't sleep. but it has a tremendous outcome on the history of the Jewish people and in their deliverance from this hour. The king couldn't sleep. Folks, who knows? Who knows in little things like that that the hand of God is not in it? In your sleeplessness, for example. That's not, I think, generally the case, but my only point is that small things, seemingly insignificant things, can become great role players in God's outcomes. Well, this certainly did. The king couldn't sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, the royal chronicles, and they were read before the king. Now, we don't know why he called for the royal chronicles. There again is the hand of God. He may have been wondering, there's something bothering me. I don't know what. What is it? And then maybe to jog his memory and kind of figure out what on earth it is that's bothering him, gnawing at him. He doesn't get up and turn on TV or go read a book, so to speak. But he calls his servants and he says, bring me the chronicles. I feel a need to read those. And so they were read before the king. And it was found written. They came across that long-forgotten good deed of Mordecai. There's the hand of God. As he read the chronicles, it was reported concerning those two conspirators who planned to assassinate the king, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who had been doorkeepers and in a very advantaged position to pull it off. Mordecai had reported that. It came to Esther, and Esther was careful enough to have this good deed chronicled not to her credit, but to Mordecai's credit. And there again was the secret hand of God, the fact that she recorded this deed as done by Mordecai, rather than taking personal credit for it. Who would have known that? I mean, I doubt if Mordecai even knew that. And the king said to his servants, well, that reminds me, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on this man Mordecai for this? The king's servants who attended him said, Your Majesty, we never did anything for him. Well, it so happened that as all of this was transpiring, and it was apparently in the morning, early morning, that there was some rustling or light commotion in the outer court, and the king said, Who's in the court? Well, wouldn't you know, here comes Haman. In the outer court of the king's palace, he had gotten up bright and early, and it was going to be the first business of the day to get rid of Mordecai. It had the gallows built, and there he is, as the sun is rising, more or less, to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai, impaling him on the gallows which he had prepared for him. And before Haman, the descendant of Agag, the Amalekite, could state his business, when Haman came in, attended by the officers of the court, the king said to him, Haman, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? Well, Haman, in his immense vanity, said to himself, who would the king desire to honor more than me? Even his vanity is used against him in the providence of God. So Haman says, well, here's what I would do, as I paraphrase very loosely, chapter 6, verse 7. Your Majesty, for the man whom the king desires to honor, thinking to himself, since it's going to be me, I want to do it big. Let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them lead the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and let the mobs adore him, and proclaim before him, Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor, thinking all the time, this is going to be me. And the king said to Haman, again we paraphrase verse 10, Oh, that's a great idea, Haman. Now I know why I elevated you to the position. Tremendous idea. So what I want you to do is take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and I want you to do for Mordecai the Jew that very thing. Do not fall short in anything of what you have said. Haman must have been humiliated to the bone. So he took the robe and the horse, and he arrayed Mordecai, and he led him on horseback through the city square. And he proclaimed before him, Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. And then when it was all over, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman, with his head covered, hurried home in mourning. Nothing could have possibly been more humiliating. When he came in from work early, Haman recounted to Zeresh's wife and all of his friends what had happened. They were expecting to hear news about the gallows and Mordecai being impaled on them, or hung, we don't know for sure. Then his wise men and Zeresh's wife said to him, "Oh boy, this is bad. This is bad. If Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of Jewish origin and you've said he is, this is terrible. You will not overcome him. You're already in a free fall before him." And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Do you see how the hand of God is causing all the pieces to fall in place and to work together? That's the way God's providence works, people. God brings all of the pieces together and works out a plan. Reminds me of that old silly television show, A-Team, which once in a while, I admit I watched. And the leader of the pack would say, "I love it when a plan comes together." The providence of God brings plans together. Well, Haman is carted off to be with the king and drink wine with Esther the queen, and I'm sure Esther got around to her point before they could get too soused. The king probably didn't want to be put off any longer, and so he said to Esther on the second day, as they drank their wine at the banquet, "Now the Lord has all the pieces in place. Well, what is your petition, Queen Esther? Let's get right to it." "I imagine. I'll grant it. What's your request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be done," which was just an expression for great willingness to do great generosity. Well, Esther answered and said, "Your Majesty, if I found favor in your sight and it pleased the king, let my life be given to me as my petition and my people as my request." For, and this comes as a shock to the king, he has no clue what she's talking about. "For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Your Majesty, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with an annoyance to the king." The king asked Esther, "Who are we talking about here, and where is such a person who would presume to do this?" And Esther said, "Your Majesty, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Oh, boy, Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. He had no clue she was a Jewess. She had never revealed it at the request of Mordecai. Do you see the providence of God in Mordecai's request? He never knew how all this was going to shape up, but all of a sudden this card becomes a big player in the whole drama. The king is mortified. He rose in anger from drinking and went into the garden. Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he could see from the king's face that harm had been determined against him by the king. When the king shortly returned from the palace garden, the place where they had been banqueting, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. They weren't sitting in chairs. They ate in a reclined position, and he was so desperate that he virtually was on the couch with her, which prompted the king to say, "Is the guy even going to assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out from the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And guess who got impaled on those gallows? It was Haman. They hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai. And then the king's anger subsided. My, the providence of our great God. That same God is our God, and he works in our behalf as well. Thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com, and our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.